I'm Spencer Beckwith for KUNM. The coyote has inspired a range of reactions over time. Revered as a deity by native peoples, then marked for extermination by the federal government. Derided as a living, breathing allegory of want by Mark Twain. Then crowned king of cool by the Beat Generation. It's the subject of a fascinating new book, Coyote America, by New Mexico writer Dan Flores. Dan, welcome.
Very good to be here, Spencer.
Now, at the center of your book is the relationship between coyotes and humans, but mostly the similarities between coyotes and humans.
Indeed, yes. Coyotes share a lot of evolutionary adaptations with us. We do a lot of the same things, and in fact, I think one of the reasons we and coyotes both are successful species in the world is because of some of these similarities that we have in our evolution.
And two of the examples you give in the book are intelligence and flexibility.
Well, I think that's probably why Indians were attracted to coyotes in the first place, is they recognize a common intelligence. This is an animal that goes through the world being smart, and it's kind of a model for humans.
And one of the things you explore also in the book is why coyotes were able to survive the effort to exterminate them in a way that wolves were not. And what we've been talking about is an example of how they were able to do that.
This sort of staggered the imaginations of many of the people back in the beginning of the 20th century who were trying to exterminate coyotes. They began to notice by the 1920s or so, as wolves were disappearing under the onslaught of a government agency called the Bureau of Biological Survey, that wolf numbers were dropping dramatically year after year after year, and it did seem indeed possible to at least, if not exterminate them, extirpate them in local areas, get rid of them. They were going to survive somewhere else, but get rid of them locally. Coyotes, you couldn't even do that to. And that began to emerge as a kind of an epiphany, a new revelation for a lot of these government hunters in the 1920s. And they started trying to figure out why this was. No matter how many coyotes they seemed to kill, and they were setting out sometimes in the middle 20s as many as 3.5 million poison baits across the West a year. But coyotes always seemed to be back in the same numbers, if not more, every year. And one of the reasons for that, I realize, is that coyotes long ago evolved this ability to respond to pressure in a very similar way that we have as a species, which primarily has to do with either working together as packs like wolves do. Turned out that made wolves vulnerable to being poisoned, though, because if you poison one animal out of a wolf pack, you could bait all the other animals with the scent of that one and kill all of them. So coyotes had something else, and that was a fission ability. We call this adaptation fusion fission.
Right.
And what it means is when you're under pressure, you have the ability, and not very many species have that. I'll tell you. You have the ability to scatter into singles and pairs across the landscape so that you're not so easily garnered and killed. And so that adaptation is one of the reasons coyotes basically, in response to hunting and pressure and poisoning, scattered across all of North America. I mean, we basically drove them out of the West, across the Mississippi River. Now they're in every single state in the Union except for Hawaii.
There is, despite this awareness on the part of humans that coyotes are similar to us and were able to survive in the same way we did, there is still this sharp difference of opinion in American society about coyotes.
Coyotes are political. There are people in this country who are tremendous fans and advocates of coyotes. And that's been, as with wolves, a fairly recent thing. It basically emerged as a result of the ecology movement, our understanding of the role that predators play in nature. And so an appreciation for animals like wolves and coyotes. began to emerge really in the 1970s and the 1980s. But there are still a lot of people in America who have been used to considering them for a long time, almost trained by the Bureau of Biological Survey to think this way, that this animal is a vermin, it's trash, and it's almost your patriotic duty whenever you see one to kill it. And so we've sort of ended up in modern America with two different camps about coyotes. And it's sort of characterized in part by two different pronunciations of the name. We all know that there are lots of people out there who refer to this animal as a coyote. And in fact, I've got a friend who says, you know, anytime you shoot one, you never call it a coyote. You call it a coyote. And on the other hand, people who don't shoot them and who do tend to appreciate them usually use the three-syllable name. And it's an interesting story, too, how those two names sort of emerged in American cultural life. They both kind of came out of Anglo-Americans coming to the Southwest in the middle of the 19th century. And an animal that most Americans since Lewis and Clark had referred to as the prairie wolf, they suddenly began to realize had a different name. And the term coyote actually comes from the Nahuatl language, which is the Aztec language. And it spells C-O-Y-O-T-L, but the Aztec speakers pronounced the name coyote. But when Spaniards heard that name, they Hispanicized it to coyote. And then when Anglo-Americans heard it, some of them were okay with coyote, although they gave it a little sort of an American twist. But a lot of the mountain men who were in the northern New Mexico region from the 1820s to the 1850s just couldn't really brook a three-syllable pronunciation. So they're the ones who began calling it a coyote, and they're the ones who took that word back to the Midwest and to the rural South, where it still is a very, very common pronunciation.
The book is really a chronological history of the coyote. Why did you decide on that structure, Dan?
Well, I wanted it to have a narrative direction. I didn't want it to be simply an assemblage of linked essays, and it could have been that. I mean, I've written books that basically are like that, and I wanted this one to have more of a thread. And so after an introduction where I pose a lot of these issues like pronunciation and the politics of coyotes in the modern world and lots of other things. I kind of argue that the coyote is the original dude, and the dude for sure abides. But I also felt some obligation to start at the beginning. And this is a family of animals that evolved in North America. The canid family comes from North America, actually from the American Southwest, 5.3 million years ago. And so this is the family that produces wolves, jackals, coyotes. So I wanted to tell that story, but I wanted to put it in the context of how humans first began to encounter these animals. And so the opening chapter, Old Man America, is basically about the evolution of the canids, but it's also about how Native people decided on this particular animal, of all the choices they had, to designate as their deity figure.
In many ways, your personal reactions to coyotes, which you share with us in the book, mirror the way society as a whole has reacted to the coyote over time.
Yes, they do, in some cases to my chagrin. I grew up in Louisiana in the rural South, and when I was 12 or 14 years old, to my absolute shock, coyotes began showing up in Louisiana. I mean, I think I say somewhere in the book, it was like rounding a corner in New Orleans and coming face to face with a moose. I mean, you just didn't think of coyotes as being animals of the bayous and the deep South. And I was 14, 15, 16 years old, and I was a rural kid, and I was fascinated with them. And so, indeed, I am forced, being honest, to tell a story about shooting one when I was a teenager. And looking in the eyes of this animal and perceiving a kind of an ancient question and not knowing how to answer it properly. I don't think I knew how to answer it properly for another 10 years. And so the coyote ends up shot, and I end up a killer at the end of that chapter. But I also follow the story through the 1960s, the age of ecology, the passage of Richard Nixon's presidential proclamation to end the poisoning of coyotes on the public lands of the West, the Endangered Species Act of 1973. I mean, as a teenager and as a young man growing up through those years, I developed, as did most of the rest of America, a very different opinion about those animals. I came to very much be an appreciator of them.
My favorite image in the book, and I'm sorry, I can't remember who related this, is the image of the coyote going along, tossing a pinon twig in the air repeatedly and catching it. And I think that fits with the image that a lot of us in New Mexico have of encountering a coyote.
Yes. To me, this was a very poignant story. It was in the report to the Park Service of a biologist named Adolph Murie, who was given the task of studying coyotes in Yellowstone National Park in the late 1930s with the idea that his study was going to demonstrate that they were, as many people in government thought, the arch predator of our time and therefore were worth exterminating in order to save animals like deer and antelope and elk and so forth. And so Murie did this years-long study of coyotes and their diets in Yellowstone Park, and he ended up concluding that, in fact, to the shock of his superiors, that coyotes were by no means the arch predator of game animals, that, as he put it, these animals and their predators have been intertwined for so long before Americans ever came to the continent, that it's really an act of hubris for us to think that we're going to come in and somehow overnight weed the place properly and get rid of these predators. But to go to your story, in the course of doing this, he was standing by a game trail one morning in Yellowstone and got the opportunity to watch this coyote trotting by on a trail. And the coyote didn't see him. And what he saw was this coyote had a sprig of sagebrush actually in its mouth.
Sagebrush.
And it was tossing the sprig of sagebrush in the air and catching it and trotting a few more feet and doing it again. And as far as Murie could see this animal disappearing down the trail, it was joyously tossing the sprig of sage. And what it made him realize is that this was an animal that took tremendous joy in life. And it also made him know that he didn't want to be associated with a bureau that was teaching people to hate an animal that took joy in its own existence like that.
What was the main reason that you wanted to sit down and write this book?
This is, in American history, a very misunderstood, persecuted animal, I think for ideological reasons, but not for reasons of solid science or being compassionate and fair about them. And so I will confess, one of the things I hoped to do with this book was to make people stop engaging in knee-jerk stereotype reactions to them and pay more attention, to look more closely, and to see extraordinarily remarkable example of an American native. I think I say at some point in the book, the more you know about coyotes, because they come from this very landscape, the more American you're going to end up being.
New Mexico's Dan Flores is the author of Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History. It's just published by Basic Books. Thanks so much for joining us, Dan.
Oh, it was great. I enjoyed it.
I'm Spencer Beckwith.